The book of Daniel begins with the story of the life of one very special servant of God. The setting was at a time of great political and moral turmoil in the nation of Judah. And the sins of the nation were starting to bring God's judgments at an incremental level, like he says he will do in various other prophecies in the Bible. God had been long-suffering with Judah for a long time. It had been maybe 135 years since the downfall of their brethren, the northern 10 tribes, as they were marched into Assyria, and most of them never returned, but were assimilated in lands and eventually migrated northwest towards northwest Europe and other places in the region. But that Judah was still suffering through God's watching and sending prophets and examination and to see what they would do. So Jeremiah had been pleading with the nation to turn from their wicked ways for about 20 years when the book of Daniel begins. He started his message about 626 BC. Now, to get a perspective of the uncertain social and political climate in Daniel's childhood, Judah's last righteous king, Josiah, and very high regards are given in the Bible after his death. Josiah and Hezekiah both are elevated quite high, other than, of course, the gold standard being King David. But other kings that were considered righteous kings included Josiah and Hezekiah. But Josiah was abruptly killed in a battle. He came up in a skirmish against Necho, the Pharaoh of Egypt, after being warned not to. He died. Now the next two kings following him were Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim. They had very short reigns. Jehoahaz ruled Judah for 3 months, and then Jehoiakim only ruled for 11 years. The tradition in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in Judah and Israel, was that if you were blessed by God and you had a good reign, you would probably reign for 40 years. Now, there were some anomalies, like Manasseh, a very wicked king, who ruled for 55 years. But as a rule, 40 years was considered a good reign of your leadership with God's blessing. So these two kings, Jehoiakim in 3 months and Jehoiakim, they reversed many of the reforms that Josiah had put in place in Judah. And God was still testing the people at that time. Now, Babylon was the rising world power. Assyria was when they attacked Israel 135 years earlier. Now Babylon was the rising power, the dominant power of the day, and they were slowly taking land and peoples from the outside perimeters of Judah into captivity. And there, if there would be no repentance, God was preparing Babylon to be, as he says in Jeremiah 27 and chapter 50, God's servant, the hammer of the whole earth. And so God was raising up an enemy should Judah not have a major and lasting turnaround. Well, we know the story. They didn't. They didn't. Let's open our Bibles to now to that point in which the story begins in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. Takes us to this setting of 605 BC. Daniel 1, verse 1, this is when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, ordered the siege of Judah and the taking of the first three groups of Jewish captives on into Babylon. Verse 1, in the third year, the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to attack the cities of Judah, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, meaning the Solomon's temple, which he had carried into the land of Shinar, Babylon, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Now, a little more background, a little more setting. Daniel is young. He's about 15 years old by adding different calculations to what's going on at the start of the story here. He's from a royal family line. He's got some nobility in his blood. He and a number of other youths are taken to serve Nebuchadnezzar in the palace in Babylon. It would have been a long, painful journey for a caravan of families to be deported. Having to walk for several months, a distance between 700 and 900 miles. Just to give you a taste of how arduous and painful such a journey was. And this was just the first of three deportations. Daniel was among them. Then, 8 years later, it's 597 BC, a second group was deported. You can see that Judah had not changed its ways. It was still seeped in idolatry, Sabbath breaking, and the other sins and evils and wickedness and the violence in the land. And so a second group was deported. This included the prophet Ezekiel this time. He went into Babylon as a deportee, and he wrote long prophecies while he was in exile there. 11 years later, 586, 587 BC, in that time frame, a 2.5 year serious siege of the capital, Jerusalem itself. Starvation ensued, a slaughter, and massive numbers of people were then taken as captives and walked to Babylon. And it is estimated, combining several different biblical numbers of that exile, the third one, that maybe 20,000 people from Judah were taken up as slaves and marched to Babylon. So you can see that how God was trying to get their attention through prophets and yearning for them to have change of heart and behavior before he brought a total collapse of the government, the burning and destruction of the temple, the taking away of Zedekiah, their last king, who died in captivity after watching his sons being slain right in front of his eyes, and then having his eyes taken out. It was just a horrible last sight for the last king of Judah. Horrible things happened. Even Jeremiah himself was one of the deportees who was taken along with that third group of exiles until a Babylonian official stopped the group and said for Jeremiah to return, to go back and kind of help out for the few that were still left in the land. Mostly the poor were left in the land, whereas all the wealthy and the nobles and the people with skills and talents and abilities were drug away. But Jeremiah was left to turn back and go back to Judah and help where he could. Now, we get to the core of where I'm going today. What I'd like to share with you today are four crises in the life of this remarkable hero of faith, Daniel, and what we can learn from how he handled these four crises. The title is very simple. Daniel, the man of God. Daniel, the man of God. Now we pick up on verse 3. We're in Daniel 1, verse 3. The story focuses on this teenager again, maybe about 15 years old. He arrives in Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar orders the chief of the court officials to search out some of the captive young men of Judah, of royal ancestry and nobility, to be trained in an intensive 3-year training program to serve the king in his palace. Verse 3, then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language, the literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. So they were going to undergo intensive training in language, history, religion, astrology, sciences, mathematics, whatever have you, literature of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. And they were a select group of all those in that first deportation that showed skills to learn fast. They were young enough, they were moldable, they were teachable, and that they came from prominent families. So they had this 3-year course. And to begin the process, each was given a new name. A little backstory on that. In ancient times, the power to name something or somebody that you have control over or that you've dominated or that you've put your authority over was important. The Babylonians did not want to have their slaves named in honor of their gods that they were brought away from. So if they conquered a people, they gave them new names based on the gods of Babylon. Daniel in Hebrew means God my judge. God is my judge. And the new names were, in his case, Belteshazzar. Belteshazzar means Bel, protect the king. Now, Bel was a chief pagan god in Babylon. It's in the Aramaic form for the chief Canaanite god, Baal, or Baal, also known as Marduk or Merodach in various places in the Bible. And so this Canaanite god, Bel, was used as far as Daniel's new Babylonian name. Here comes a crisis number 1 of 4. Now, this is not a life and death crisis, but this starts to form a pattern that can be seen in the leadership in Babylon as far as Daniel's wisdom, his discretion, his discernment, and his uncanny, or should I say, unusual abilities. The first challenge for Daniel in the royal court of the king involved the food and drink that he was served over that course of 3 years. Let's read verse 8 together. But Daniel purposed in his heart he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine in which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, we've heard over the years there was something obviously wrong with the food. Now, the Bible's not clear in pointing out to us whether the food was unfit for human consumption. In the New Testament, the word would be akathartos. Akathartos just means that. Food that says unclean in the English translations, but really means unfit for humans to eat. Or was it ceremonially unclean? The Greek word in the New Testament would be koinos in discussing the distinction between food that we wouldn't eat. Our grandkids are having fun learning about the kinds of foods. You could ask them, will you eat lizards? No. Will you eat snails? No. Will you eat worms? No. Will you eat snakes? No. And so they're learning those things that are not fit for human consumption. Now, in the days that we're talking about here, there was more to the ceremonial law. The koinos, foods that Wycliffe commentary says religion affected all areas of life for the pagans. Flesh from the king's table was probably slain according to pagan ritual and offered to a god. What did God have to say about that in Exodus? Well, Exodus 34, verse 15. I won't turn there. It's just an aside here. Exodus 34:15 points out that Israel was to abstain from eating meat sacrificed to a pagan god, as it was an invitation to engage in pagan practices, because it might lure God's people, the Israelites, to engage in more and more pagan activity. And so that may be what Daniel is thinking of here. We're not told for sure. What about the wine? He didn't want to drink the delicacies of the king. He didn't want to drink his wine either. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary suggests perhaps the grape harvest was also ceremonially offered to a pagan god. To have partaken of such food and drink would have been to sanction idolatry, which was forbidden under Moses' law, ceremonial law. So whatever it was, Daniel put it in his heart. He resolved in his heart to do what he could. Now, let's see how Daniel handled this. There was a solution. Verses 8 through 10, Daniel approaches the chief eunuch on behalf of himself and his three friends. He's tactful, he's humble, he's diplomatic, and he says, I will give you a demonstration after 10 days if you just let me do this, if you get approval for me not to eat these things, but just eat mostly vegetables. Verses 8 through 10, but Daniel purposed in his heart he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine in which he drank. Therefore he requested of the king of the eunuch, chief of the eunuchs, that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. It's like when Joseph served under Potiphar. It's like when Jesus Christ was growing up as a child and he gained favor with God and men, it says. There is something to be said about his nature, his decorum, how he approached people, his humility, and his tactfulness. Something to be said for Daniel being able to approach the chief of the eunuchs and petition him this way. Verse 9, now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear the Lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces look worse than the men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. Now, again, Daniel just says, if you will, just please give me 10 days and I'll show you. Now, why were 15, 16, 17-year-olds drinking wine? I don't know. You know, you can go over to France and any age is an okay age to drink wine, right? I've been there with my family in France for the feast. You can get wine for breakfast, lunch, and dinner if you want to. Not breakfast. Okay, lunch and dinner. Okay, Mr. Dubois says not breakfast. We were at a resort where maybe they only had the taps that you pull your own, you fill your own glass of wine. Maybe they were sitting there but unused at breakfast. Maybe I was exaggerating. Whatever the case, Daniel said, no, give me 10 days. Now, there is something, I won't turn, but Proverbs 25, verse 15, speaks to perhaps Daniel's approach. Proverbs 25, verse 15 simply says, by long forbearance, a ruler is persuaded, and a gentle tongue breaks a bone. A gentle tongue will go far. A person who has tact and diplomacy. Proverbs 15, verse 1. Similarly, Proverbs 15, verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. So, just a little principle being applied there that we can learn from. Let's go to verse 17. We're still in chapter 1, verse 17. Continues to speak of the special abilities that these four particularly had out of the larger group of youths who were taken to Babylon. As for these four men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Verse 18. Now at the end of the days, now we're talking about 3 years. I went to several commentaries to be sure we weren't talking about the 10-day trial on the diet issue. This is after the 3 years of training. When the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And as you know, those are their Hebrew names. Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would be their Babylonian given names. I won't go into the entomology of those names, but here it mentions their Hebrew names. Now it speaks to very special abilities Daniel and his three friends had, more than the others. They were well-bred. They were bright, talented, a number of them, again, from nobility. And Daniel and his friends just happened to be a little more gifted than the rest. Continue with me. Verse 20. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding, about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. Again, Daniel now, after 3 years, is, according to some calculations, is about 18 or 19 years old. He's still a teenager at this time, perhaps. That's our best estimate from scholarship. 18 or 19 years old. Where did he learn such discipline? Most likely at home in Jerusalem, growing up with his family, with his parents. We don't know what happened to Daniel's parents. We're not told anything about his parents. The story only begins when he arrives in Babylon. And he had to rely on his character training and his religious education from what he received before he was taken into captivity. Now he's immersed in this pagan culture, and he has more challenges that lie ahead. It says in verse 21, thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Verses 1 through 21 are basically an introduction to the rest of the book. It kind of closes it's like a chapter closure where it shows that he served all the rest of his life, perhaps even into his 90s. Estimate is that this one passage, that he served until the first year of King Cyrus, gives us a key to how long Daniel served in the court of the king in Babylon. It could have been 80 plus years. First he serves under Nebuchadnezzar, then he serves 1 to 2 years under his son, Evil-Merodach. That's his name, possibly Nebuchadnezzar's own son. Then he serves under King Belshazzar, which it says he's the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but some scholars feel that's actually a grandson. I'll explain more later why it's felt that way. Then he serves under King Darius the Mede when Babylon is conquered by the Medes and the Persians. And then maybe Daniel is still serving into his 90s under Persian King Cyrus. Remember, Cyrus is the king that God, maybe Daniel even opened the scroll of Jeremiah and said, look, you're mentioned in here. You're mentioned in these as the one that God will use as his servant to let the Israelites, the Jews, return back to their homeland. And so after a number of years, they are able to return, but maybe being able to see these things in the scriptures and seeing his name in there, Cyrus, the king of the Persians, that he was profoundly moved by this. So anyway, Daniel looks like he served under 5 kings and other authorities that came and went. All of them were pagans whose values did not match Daniel's, and some of those powerful men would make life very difficult for Daniel. Now, talking about Daniel as a watchman for a moment, in these days you and I are living in, we're living in a time of growing political and moral turmoil in our society as well. And Daniel is a perfect role model of leadership and excellence as a watchman for his own people while he's in Babylon. Remember, by the third deportation, tens of thousands of Jews are now in and around the Empire of Babylon. Daniel is second to the king. He is an advisor to the king, and he might play a very important role for the Jews that are watching his behavior. Now, what do I mean by Daniel as a watchman? A number of Hebrew words are translated into the English word watchman. It comes from the Hebrew word shomer. The most obvious definition is one who stands guard or stands watch. Israel's prophets saw themselves as watchmen, warning the nation of God's approaching judgments if people did not repent. Isaiah was a watchman, Jeremiah was a watchman, and many, many other prophets. When Daniel was serving in the court of the king of Babylon, he dedicated himself to bringing that pagan nation an awareness that there was one true sovereign God who rules over nations and who rules over men. And he did it through his sterling character and example and his conduct and giving himself to a regular prayer life. He was a true intercessor. I'm not even going past chapter 6 today of the book. I won't go into any of the prophecies. I won't even go into the conclusion of the story. Maybe we'll save that for another sermon or two. I'm only looking at the first 6 chapters of the book today and 4 crises that Daniel would face. So an overall theme of the entire book of Daniel is God's sovereignty over men and nations. Commentaries state that God's sovereignty over men and nations is an overriding theme of the entire book. What about our day today? What about where you and I are situated, and what other things can we pick up from this? How can we relate to his situation so far? Could we find our nation in somewhat similar circumstances, in such a state of moral decline and godlessness, which we are rapidly accelerating in? When I say that, could we find ourselves in a time when political and military weakness allows us to be powerless to stop an invasion, a foreign invasion of our outer boundaries or our protectorates and our sea gates, our military installations in faraway places in the world? Could that happen? Well, obviously, if we are students of prophecy for any number of years, yes, that could happen. We know that the time of Jacob's trouble will come if there isn't a widespread change and repentance of our nation and the English-speaking countries of the world, mainly as Israelitish nations and others. France is an Israelitish nation. Sweden, Denmark, they are Israelitish nations as well. Can you imagine being among the first to be rounded up and sent to a foreign land and never see your family, your parents, your friends ever again? It's a sobering thought. If that were to happen during a time of Jacob's trouble, does Daniel's example speak to us? I think it does. Here in the U.S., the overall mood of the nation, I touched on this a little bit last week, we see more and more division in the media. We see fake news, false promises, accusations, deteriorating ethics from the highest leaders of our land. There's sinful human condition on display 24/7 in the media. The constant flow of instantaneous print, video, music, pictures, messages, television, social media, it's dizzying. And yet we have to stand as watchmen in our example, you and me. Internationally, the issues of our day have become so complex that it's truly going to take God sending his son back to this earth and the humbling of nations to steer them into a godly way of life and to learn from Jesus Christ's government and to learn peace in this world. It will take Jesus Christ's return, because we believe we're past a tipping point where humankind, and this was thought back in the 1970s and 80s when I was reading Plain Truth magazines, we were wondering if at that time we had reached a point where we couldn't have enough ability in human intelligence, human effort, human energies to try to turn around the ills of the world. Are we that much further along now? Yes, we are. But in spite of what's seen on the surface, our prayers can have a powerful effect even on our leaders. We can pray that our leaders will govern honestly, humbly, and with justice. We can pray for them to have knowledge and understanding. Here's a little aside from just watching the news this week. Some of the latest investigative reporting on the top law enforcement agencies of this land, namely the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and some of the high officials in the FBI have been looked at as, you know, trying to overturn a duly elected president in the last couple of years. And more information is slowly coming out as to who was involved and was this at the very, very high levels of government. The FBI, I learned this week, has 35,000 employees. And they look to their top leadership for guidance, for example, and for staying with the principles set forth to become an FBI agent. The oath you see on their motto, you can go on Wikipedia and see their motto. It has three words on it: fidelity, bravery, and integrity. Fidelity, bravery, and integrity are on the motto. Then it says Federal Bureau of Investigation. Well, we know that these values are eroding in our country, but you and I can certainly hold those values close, as Daniel did. Now let's go to crisis number 2 out of 4. We're moving into Daniel chapter 2, verse 5. Daniel chapter 2, verse 5. Crisis number 2. The story now focuses on the first of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. The story focus zooms in on Nebuchadnezzar. These dreams cause him great distress. Daniel is going to be caught up in the middle of it. He's not trying to have his, you know, get in the way, but Nebuchadnezzar is beside himself, and he calls every one of his wise men, astrologers, enchanters, just magicians, whatever names they have in the Bible here, to come and not only interpret the dream, but tell me what my dream was. And they start stalling for time, and they're very nervous because he threatens their lives. And he says, you better tell me what my dream was. Oh, please, God, nobody can do that. No, God, no, please, O king. Nobody can do that. He says, no, you're just buying time here. You tell me my dream and then tell me what it means. So finally, they find Daniel. Daniel 2, verse 5, King Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to the Chaldeans, astrologers and magicians, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and the interpretation, you'll be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell me the dream and its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. Verse 13, here it talks about how the decree to execute all these wise men, enchanters, magicians, and astrologers, to execute them. And Daniel and his friends were being sought out for the command to be executed as well. You can see that in the narrative. Daniel and his friends were also on the short list. What does Daniel do? He learns about this decree. He asks the king for some time so that he could interpret the dream for him. Skip to verse 16 with me. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went into his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his companions, that they might seek mercies from God in heaven concerning this secret. What does that mean? That means they got down on their knees and prayed for God's help on this matter. They prayed in a desperate time when their lives were also in the balance. They prayed, seeking the mercies of God from heaven and concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Egypt, of Babylon. So there's this much more serious problem looming now. Daniel doesn't have the solution yet. He goes to the one who can solve the problem, God himself. He inquires of God in this difficult matter. The lesson for us is obvious. It's so simple, is that if there are problems we cannot personally solve, we come to God before his mighty throne of grace in times of need. Let's hold our place in Daniel 2 and go to 1 Timothy 2 and verse 1. We're going to come back. In fact, you'll have very little shifting around in your Bible with me on this this message. Come back. But 1 Timothy 2 and verse 1. Paul here is urging the brethren to pray even for evil authorities. Verse 1. Therefore I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. Verse 4, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Jesus Christ, who gave himself a ransom for all to be testified in due time, for which I was appointed a preacher and an apostle. I'm speaking the truth in Christ, and I'm not lying, Paul says, a teacher to the Gentiles in faith and truth. Verse 8, he continues, therefore, I desire, therefore, that all that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. And so here, Paul is instructing us to pray for our leaders, regardless of their moral conduct, but good and bad, not against them, but to pray with two goals in mind. One, that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity, as Paul pointed out. And two, so that everyone, leaders and ordinary citizens, can be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. That's a noble prayer. That's a noble prayer for those that we may not even agree with, or we, you know, people that we look at in the news and we wag our heads at some of the carelessness, reckless words and frivolity and foolish decisions made at the highest levels of government. We're still to pray for them. Is that hard to do? Yes. Yes. But this is something that we're admonished to do. 1 Peter 2:17, I won't turn, but it says, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king, or whoever the ruler is. Proverbs 24:21 says, my son, fear the Lord and the king. And so one of the ways we can honor those in authority is by praying for them. Whether we like them or not, whether we agree with their policies or not, this is a call to prayer. Let's go back to Daniel 2:19, please. Come back with me to Daniel 2:19. God answers Daniel's prayer as he and his three friends beseech God, because a lot of lives are on the line, including the families of those astrologers and magicians and wise men, of which Babylon was renowned for. Verse 19, then the secret was revealed to Daniel in the night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He thanks God again for answering that prayer. Verse 20, Daniel answered and said, and this is an inspired moment of speech. This is one of those things where you see in many cases where God is inspiring and stirring the heart of somebody to speak profound things. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. Verse 23, I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we have asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. He's so thankful. Now many lives are going to be saved. Daniel, no doubt, hurried back to the king without losing any time. Verse 27, skip to verse 27. Here he goes back and he says to the king, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare this to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Now again, I'm not going into those prophecies that point to our day today and the generation that we live in. But as it concerns Nebuchadnezzar, he's the first of the four ruling kingdoms, the head of gold of the image in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made it known to you what will be. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone else. But for our sakes, now there's an interesting interpretation of our sakes. It makes it look like, if you're reading New King James Version, that he's talking about just you and me, king, just for our sakes, God did this. But it goes beyond that, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. A better interpretation you'll find in more modern translations is for their sakes, for everyone's sake. The purpose for the interpretation was given by God for the sake of the king and the nation of Babylon to know that there was a sovereign God in heaven that was superior to any gods of wood and stone, including their chief god, Bel, and that also all future generations should know this. We note here that Daniel takes no credit for this interpretation, this revelation. Through it, it would save many lives of the families in Babylon, though. Daniel 2, verse 48. Verse 48, then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. So now he's in a very elevated position. Also, Daniel petitioned the king and set his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. What's that mean? It means he was in a position of judgment, making rules, making judgments on right and wrong issues and cases that were presented to him. What's a lesson we can learn here? We should give God the credit for our talents and our abilities and our spiritual gifts. God gives every one of us spiritual gifts. He gives every human being, called or not, talents and abilities to serve and to give and to share with others. And so we can see that Daniel gave God the glory and the praise and honor that he might have received from men. The servants of God are not to claim glory for their own talents and abilities, but to attribute that to the very grace and generosity of God. That's what we can learn from this. In 1 Peter 5, verse 5, I won't turn, 1 Peter 5, verse 5, talks about what happens to you and me if we are going through a period of trial where we look like we're low man on the totem pole, everybody's against me, I'll go out and eat worms. Now, my little grandsons heard that. They weren't listening. Never mind. It's just an old colloquial saying. I think I'll go eat worms. So when you feel that way, listen to this quote that Peter quotes from Proverbs 3. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another. Be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud. He gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. God can raise us up. God can bring us down. He looks on the human heart. He's always looking at our hearts. He was looking at Nebuchadnezzar's heart, as we're going to see in a moment. This is one of the qualities of character that Daniel had whenever he approached with a difficult situation, the king or the chief of the eunuchs or some other nobility. And it was really God who placed Daniel and his friends in these influential positions. It's God who steers events in yours and my personal lives. As long as we're humble, God can use us in wonderful ways. Sometimes humanly we say, I can't do something, but with God, anything is possible. As long as we have a humble heart, God can do marvelous things through you and me. That was crisis number two. To save many people from execution, including Daniel himself and his three friends. Crisis number three takes us to Daniel chapter 3. Now, scholars suggest that suddenly 20 years have passed. It's about 20 years later that this was recorded for our learning. This was the crisis of whether to worship the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar erected. Some scholars think, was it a statue representing their god Bel or some other chief deity, or was it a statue of Nebuchadnezzar's likeness? We're not told. We don't know. But some feel that it was 40 feet tall, big enough to see from a far distance on the horizon. And of course, all the music and the musicians and the clamor when it was time to bow toward this god, this became part of the daily routine, it looks like. So it would be in direct defiance to worship the one true God to bow down to this image. Now the narrative shifts to this crisis for Daniel and his three friends. We can see jealousy rising up with the other nobles and officials and governors against these Hebrew men because of their high level of position. Nebuchadnezzar was enraged when the complaint was brought about the three men that had, under pain of death, would not bow down to this golden image. Well, I mentioned earlier that Daniel and his three friends were involved, but actually his three friends are in the narrative. Where is Daniel in this situation? Well, we're not told. Is he in a position such that some of these critics and complainers wouldn't dare bring an accusation against Daniel himself? We're not told. We don't know. But his three friends are caught up in this. So Daniel very likely becomes quickly aware of this predicament. Or maybe his friends send a message to him. We don't know. Likely, though, Daniel is already again in intercessory prayer, asking God what path, what direction, guide him in what to do next. Let's pick up Daniel 3, verse 15. We break into the verse of Nebuchadnezzar threatening anyone who does not bow down. If you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. The NIV puts it this way, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. Verse 17, if that's the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand. One way or another, deliver us in life, deliver us in death. Their hearts were resolved to not bow down and worship this idol. This would have huge implication in the days to come, as you'll see. Verse 18, let it be known, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. In other words, even if God doesn't deliver us alive, we will not compromise. Powerful statement of their conviction and their loyalty to the one sovereign God in heaven. The lesson for us, again, is very obvious. God will deliver his people from harm's way, either in death or in life. He can and may deliver us from temporal death, but undoubtedly, he can also deliver us from the ultimate death penalty, which is everlasting death, in which there is no resurrection, which is to be avoided at all costs. So they didn't hesitate on what course to choose. What would it do for them if they compromised? If they compromised, they would receive maybe restoration, or they'd be restored in a very temporal, physical life, if they felt, but they would fall out of God's favor. If they had to go through a temporal death with a certain promise of something much better that will last for eternity, they made the good choice. They made the right choice. They trusted in God. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, the miraculous deliverance of the three godly youths from the fiery furnace, as recorded in chapter 3, manifested the glory of God before Nebuchadnezzar at a time when the pagan world power seemed triumphant and the cause of the people of God appeared hopeless. Two things resulted: the example to the Jews of resisting their tendency toward idolatry. Remember I mentioned Daniel's role as watchman for his people? This is a commentary. This is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggesting that maybe the rest of the Jews that were in captivity watched and learned from Daniel's three friends' example. And two, the captive people of God would gain respect on part of the pagan rulers, which would lessen the severity of their exile, and which ultimately would lead to the issue of the decree from King Cyrus, not only to restore them, but also to ascribe honor to the one living God of heaven before the whole pagan world. So God does things in wonderful ways to bring light to dark areas of the earth where paganism is so extant. God can do wonderful things through even one or two or three of his faithful followers. Daniel 3, verse 23. We break into the story of the powerful effect the three friends of Daniel had on Nebuchadnezzar. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the fiery burning furnace. The king was astonished. He rose in haste and he spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Now, scholars say that Nebuchadnezzar could have said, "a son of the gods," not knowing the pre-incarnate word or Jesus Christ, "a son of the gods." Either way, it is more than likely Jesus Christ. He's also called an angel here. The term in Hebrew, malak, meaning messenger. And Jesus Christ is referred to as malak, the angel of the Lord, at times in the Old Testament. Verse 26, then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God." You see, it's already rubbing off on Nebuchadnezzar. "Servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then they did, came out from the fire. Verse 27, then the satraps, administrators, governors, and king's counselors, lots of witnesses. This is important too. Lots of people saw this. Lots of people learned of it. The word could spread faster. It was more undeniable of a miracle. They looked at these men, they examined their hair, not a hair in their head was singed, their garments didn't smell of smoke, anything like that. Amazing. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel," again, Malak in capital letters, "and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word, and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God." Verse 29, Nebuchadnezzar makes a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss of their God now, the one true God, shall be cut in pieces and their houses shall be made an ash heap. You must have liked that phrase. It was intimidating. There is no other God who can deliver such as this. Then they were promoted. They were promoted and elevated. Let's skip over to chapter four. Let's continue. A number of years pass again. That's interesting about reading Old Testament narratives in various books, that there can be between two sentences, a passage of a decade, a generation, there could be thousands of years in prophecies between one sentence and the next sentence. So here we see in this book a very condensed life in the first six chapters of a number of years of life of Daniel. Condensed down. Daniel's been in Babylon about 52 years now at the start of chapter 4. About 52 years. So he could be close to 70 years old. The focus of this chapter turns again to Nebuchadnezzar and how God struck him suddenly for his pride and arrogance to become like an animal and to perhaps take his human spirit away, the spirit in man away for those 7 years, so that he ate grass like an ox, his hair grew long, and his fingernails grew long like the talons of a bird. So what's he saying here? Daniel 4, verse 30, in the height of the glorious beauty of Babylon, he says, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling in my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" Buttons are popping off of his gown and he's just loving all the praise and honor. It was a year later that God struck him down with madness for 7 years. He lived outdoors. Again, he became a wild person, I could only picture in my mind that he was probably confined to a courtyard that had grass and whatever, and that others had to fill in for him for 7 years to conduct the affairs of state. Well, probably had people throwing him food out the window. Who knows? We don't know. I'm just trying to picture in my mind, what do you do with a madman who was your king the day before? Do you let him out in the streets, or do you kind of give him a compound to try to hide him from the public view? Because this is a major embarrassment for the administration to see their king wandering around on all fours eating grass. So I'm guessing in my mind they tried to keep it low key. That's just how, you know, I would do that anyway. So he has a brain of an animal, and he's going to have a good outcome, though, after 7 years. Daniel 4, verse 34, at the end of the time, 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. Verse 36, at the same time my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. God was very generous to give him back for his remaining years of his term of kingship, his rulership. Give him back and preserve the kingdom for that period of time. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom. An excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. What a transformation. And this is what God was looking for. And the outcome was what God had predicted and steered. He had a change of heart. He was a humble man now for his remaining years. And he could recognize through Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego's example, the powerful example of those four young Hebrews and perhaps others, to teach him and at least his staff in the palace that there was one sovereign God. Let's skip to Daniel chapter 5. History marches on. Daniel 5. God raises kingdoms up. He can bring kingdoms down. Babylon is about to be overthrown by the next world dominating power, the combined armies of the Medes and the Persians, for the pride and arrogance of one of the descendants of Nebuchadnezzar. Now comes into the story Belshazzar. Remember, Belteshazzar was the Babylonian name of Daniel, but this is Belshazzar. He's most likely the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Now it says his son, but evil Merodach somehow fits in between these. And there's also a point to be made. The narrative says, or it indicates, that Belshazzar doesn't know Daniel and the whole history of Daniel's influence on the kingdom. Daniel 5. I won't read this, but the narrative is of this great palatial feast in which 1,000 lords and their wives are there, and they're drinking out of the chalices and the bowls that were confiscated from Solomon's temple years before. It's a drunken debauch, and they're laughing and they're having a good old time. And what does the king see on the wall but a hand of a man writing Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin on a wall. And he's terrified. It says his hips loosened, the joints loosened under him. Maybe he collapsed on the ground, maybe worse. But whatever it was, he was terrified. And so verse 26, we pick up here. Daniel is called in because Belshazzar's wife says, there's a wise man in the kingdom who is known to be able to interpret dreams. Go send for him. They do. They bring him in. Remember, he's up in his 70s now. Verse 26, Mene, God has numbered your kingdom, Belshazzar. He's finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances. You have been found wanting. You've come short. Perez, your kingdom will be divided and be given to the Medes and the Persians. Skip to verse 30 with me. Verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, history shows that Darius and his army were able to stealthily attack in the quiet of night, and maybe they were able to watch for the least amount of watchfulness around the tower or the gates of the city of Babylon and sneak in and go right into the palace of the king and slay Belshazzar and take over the kingship. It was almost like a bloodless coup, almost. Hardly a fight from what we don't have any more details than that. Verse 22, there's a very important statement here on God's fairness and justice. Because sometimes an academic question will come up, why didn't God give Belshazzar the same kind of treatment as he did his, I'll call him grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar? And here's the reason why. Because when Daniel was called in to interpret the handwriting on the wall, he gave first a very quick rundown of the history of his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, and that he was given the heart of an animal. For 7 years, he roamed around in the grass, and what he learned from that experience. Verse 22, but you, his son, again, more literally grandson, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. It's very important. God is a very fair judge. He's a very fair God. He judges people based on what they know and what they do with what they know. You knew all this, and you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. Verse 23, it talks about what was just taking place there in the big banquet. You brought the vessels from his house, God's temple, before you. You and your lords, your wise concubines, you've drunk the wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which do not see, nor hear, nor know. And the God who holds your breath in his very hand owns all your ways, and you have not glorified him. Belshazzar, you knew these things. There's the lesson. Belshazzar apparently knew the episode of Nebuchadnezzar and what it did to him in humbling him, and the arrogance and the pride, and how he came out of that after 7 years of madness until he would declare the sovereignty of the one true God. Interesting how history can repeat itself over and over again when people don't learn. Let's finally look at one more trial, one last one. It's crisis number 4 out of the 4 today that would test Daniel in his later years. And Daniel's about 80 now, based on adding together different factors by scholars. He's about 80. He's still one who will not compromise when another new test comes along. It's kind of rough when you have a major test at age 80. And here's Daniel able to do it. But it's because God is going to use these things again to teach marvelous things now to a whole new king and entourage that surrounds King Darius the Mede. Verse 1 of chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, supervisors, and then 3 governors, of whom Daniel was one. So over these 120 leaders are 3 governors, and Daniel's one of them. And verse 3, then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the entire realm. Just like kind of Joseph was put in that position by Pharaoh of Egypt. Only this time, there are some very jealous nobles and governors who don't want this to happen. So they look for a way to undermine and to cause harm for Daniel. Verse 4. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could not find any charge nor fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error found in or fault found in him. Then these men said, We shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So they go to fabricate a law. They create one. They put it on paper or parchment, and they present it to the king for a buy-in, for the king to be sold on it and sign his name to it. It's not even a law that exists yet. So this blamelessness of conduct, they really struggle to find fault in Daniel until they fabricate something. They make a plan, they prepare the decree. It's for forbidding any person in the realm to ask anything of God or man except of Darius the king for the space of 30 days. A violation of this decree would be punished by casting the offender into the den of lions. What's the lesson for us? Well, again, Daniel stands as a fine example of fidelity, bravery, and integrity. And again, I borrowed those three terms from the motto of the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation. Fidelity, bravery, and integrity. Daniel boldly, yet humbly, declared that no earthly power has the right to come between God and his faithful followers. What's he do? Immediately he goes home, he goes to his upper room, opens the windows that face Jerusalem. He got down on his knees, and for three times a day he continues to pray to God about this situation. When his critics say, this is just an interpretation, when critics say, don't pray, Daniel says, in effect, I will pray, and I will not compromise in prayer. I will not compromise in obedience to my God. And of course, that they caught him in this. They saw him. They watched for him. They spied on him and saw him open his windows and pray out the window. They bring the message to Darius the king. Verse 11, then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. They went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree, which they persuaded him to sign. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, will be cast into the den of lions? Well, yeah, that's the law of the Medes and Persians. This thing is, yeah, it does not alter. Now, Darius was heartsick. He had to realize immediately that this was a trap, that his other governors placed him in this position and did this to trap Daniel. It was not for zeal for the king's glory and honor, but jealousy against Daniel. Daniel 6, verse 14. And the king, when he heard these words, were greatly displeased with himself. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to figure out a way. How can I get Daniel out of this? The law of the Medes and Persians do not change. It does not set in stone, and I signed it with my own hand. How can I get him out of this? So, verse 16, the king has to go through it. King gave the command. They brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. This is a vote of confidence. Darius recognizes the past, Daniel and his relationship with the one sovereign God of heaven. We again see Daniel's fidelity, his bravery, and his integrity coming out in a time of trial. Through that night, King Darius goes to his palace. He spends the night fasting. He cannot sleep. No musicians were brought before him, and he waits and watches and listens. Verse 20, and when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Apparently he can't see him through a wall or whatever it is. Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and shut the mouths of the lions so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Darius knows that. He knows that already. Verse 23, now the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken out of the den, no injury whatsoever found on him, because he believed in his God. Verse 28, so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian, at least the first year of Cyrus. Final lesson as I close today, final lesson. from the stories of Daniel's deliverance, we may learn that in times of trial, God's people should be just the same way as they are in times of peace, prosperity, and harmony, and contentment, and their prospects of good as during times of trial. It is said that character does not reveal itself when things are going comfortably and smoothly. Character reveals itself only under periods of stress and trial. That's when the true person shows through. Daniel in the lion's den was the same Daniel who stood before the king as chief among the governors and the advisors, and as a prophet of the eternal sovereign God of heaven. A man or woman whose heart is stayed on God will be the same in the hour of his or her greatest trial as in times of prosperity and peace. A man of like passions as ourselves, nobody could find fault with him in his day-to-day affairs. They couldn't find fault. He was an example of what every one of us may become when his or her motives are right in the sight of God. And finally, the motto, once again, the three words that I capitalized on today, Daniel reflected to the glory of God in a pagan land all his life from the time he was taken as a teenager to serve in the court of the kings, five kings, fidelity, bravery, and integrity. Those three shone brightly in Daniel's life, the man of God.